Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate you being willing to go forward despite the absence of your Senate colleagues. I'm worried that I have been sufficiently boring over the last several days to slowly. I'm hoping that at least Mr. Wilson will be here on Monday for our completion of this portion of our presentation.
What does it say about us?
House members are used to.
We just seem to be moving that direction, I guess, on the dais, and so I hope Mr. Wilson isn't next. Did want to take us back to where we had left off yesterday at Chair Devlin's recommendation to spend a few minutes at the beginning of today walking through the agency-wide priority ranking and discussing with you briefly the 10% reduction plan from the governor's recommended budget. As I mentioned yesterday, what the large sheet that Mr. Wilson so graciously provided you, the expanded version of our front sheet there, is a ranking of program area for the department. And as I explained yesterday, what we had originally done was to take these issues and to have broken them generally down into specific areas. Institution operations was our first one and had the first set of priority ranks. Functions and services was second. Beyond that, then it went into reentry to the community, inmate management tools, transition services. I'll get to the next one here, which is construction, and then the non-optional payments. That was the way that we had ranked them, not necessarily all of them against one another. We were asked then to go back and prepare the sheet that you have in front of you on one page. And I can tell you that by and large, as I worked with the senior management team of the department, when you got up through about 1 through 10, there was very little disagreement about the order of ranking by priority. When we moved beyond 10, there was simply, you know, kind of variations, but generally, again, the same. The challenge, obviously, in this kind of a ranking is that there are certain things that, as you're going through the process, it is hard to rank one above the other in the delivery of services which we're required to provide. And Mr. Wilson, I think, made this point yesterday, either by court case, by constitution, or other. So as you look at the ranking, you'll see the department area listed in the far left column, the program ranking as it was ranked among that program, whether it was the first issue in functions and services or the first issue in operations, and then you'll see the overall rank that we provided. And to not take you through each one of these individually, I'll give you some indication at the bottom. Essentially the non-optional payments that are identified as NOPs, you see down at the bottom. We simply gave the lowest rank, not because they're the least important, but they're frankly just something that the department doesn't really have an option with respect to how it manages those payments. But we didn't want to burn up a ranking assignment for them. So it doesn't mean that it's necessarily the least important. It's the one that we frankly don't have any discretion over how it gets ranked. But to say that it was the number one thing on our list seemed to be sending the wrong signal to you generally as you consider this list. So I wanted you to understand that. The way this works is it...
Thank you, Director Williams. That seems contrary to what the governor's put out as guidance. We were told this morning when it was testified by his education advisor that they started off with mandates and then they did debt service. You put those at the bottom and the governor said that has to be taken care of first.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnant, we certainly didn't imply that it was the bottom for purposes of being taken care of, because we listed it at the bottom because it's, in our view, viewed as something that really isn't an option. Yet we wanted to give the committee, frankly, the flavor with respect to... And I hesitate to even use the word discretionary because much of what we're going to talk about on this list is really non-discretionary, but at least something that's, you know, slightly more within the purview to resolve than simply those non-optional payments that are listed. And that was how we had structured the list. I know that many agencies, I think, have, in an effort to respond to the committee and the subcommittee and the co-chairs, have structured these perhaps slightly different. There was not a universal format that was necessarily provided for the presentation of this information. But I do want to point that out with respect to those payments and where they were identified on this list. What you have then across the top is obviously not only a description of the activity, but whether or not it was a general fund, an other fund, or a federal fund activity. You have the total funds amount, the position number and FTE component associated with those positions. You see the reflection of the governor's 10% reduction amount, and as I mentioned yesterday, for us to achieve the 10% reduction would be a $125 million reduction in our overall budget. The code number, which ties to whether it is a constitutional, federal, statutory, or debt service categorization, and then citations to any of the statutory references, where it ties to our performance measures, and the 29100 number that you see listed there is the agency number for the Department of Corrections. So that's the Department of Corrections identifier and then the identified performance measures that are our current performance measures listed in that box. And then the primary purpose code, and you'll recall in this exercise, the primary purposes had a variety of issues related to criminal justice, community development, consumer protection. Almost all of ours, in fact, I believe all of them are identified as 5, which is the criminal justice primary purpose code. So with that, I'll just be happy to walk through some of those early ranks. I think they're fairly self-explanatory in what they are, but we started out with a number one ranking on food service, and then went immediately to our general population housing, our intensive management unit housing, which is our housing unit for our most critical and serious offenders, our institutional security housing, SMU, which is our special management unit for mental health, our rental bed component, which is the general fund cost associated with renting the beds that we'll need for this biennium, and then our health services, our mental health, our pharmacy operations, the community corrections grant money for the supervision of offenders who have been released out to community, and then our physical plant were sort of where we ended up in our top 10 picks. These are prime.
Mr. Williams?
Yes.
As you look at these as individual items, for example, I can see no way that you could cut $9 million out of food service without... At least I would doubt that you could cut $9 million out of food service without closing institutions and limiting population. Could you explain to us kind of the system changes you would envision in order to impact these types of savings? And then are there any items that are savings based on efficiencies or things that wouldn't be impacted by institution or system changes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the only way for us to achieve the 10% reduction required by the governor's or by the statute that requires us to do a 10% reduction exercise off the governor's recommended budget would be to close institutions. And so the $9 million that you see there on the reduction, what the amount of the 10% reduction would be for food service purposes, is essentially the value of the food that we would save by closing the institutions that we have identified for closure to achieve the other increases. The institution security and housing general population makes up almost half of the total amount, which is $53,371,000. This reflects the strategy of not only not to open the new beds at Warner Creek or at the Madras minimum, but it would include closing the Mill Creek Institution, the Oregon State Penitentiary Minimum Facility, which is the old women's facility that sits on the grounds of the penitentiary, the Sandy Am Correctional Institution, and the Oregon State Correctional Institution, OSCI. And to do so, to close those institutions in order to save those amounts of money, we would need authorization for the early release of 1,821 existing inmates on July 1, 2005 from those existing institutions. So we would close, we would have to release, to achieve these closures, our least serious 1,821 inmates, and then the authority to release an additional 400 inmates by September 2005, which is when the new Warner Creek facility would open. So not only the authority to release those immediate ones in July, but it would also require that we, by September, have the ability to get rid of another 400 inmates, which we're anticipating having housed at the Warner Creek facility in Lakeview. And then the 864 inmates that would theoretically occupy in October 2006 the Madras minimum, those would have to be accounted for as well in the process. So you'd end up with essentially a release capacity over the biennium of a displacement of approximately 3,085 inmates, as I recall how those numbers came up, in order to achieve that level of reduction. And it's simply, again, a function of the costs associated with the population that we have and how you would have to go about achieving those kinds of savings. You'll see, as a result of those closures, a reduction in health services, a reduction in mental health treatment, a reduction in pharmacy operations, which is all a function of those institutions not being in operation. There is cost associated with closing down an institution, obviously. We have assumed in this preparation the various costs that would be tied to those reductions, the payouts of the vacation and the layoffs and all of those pieces are assumed as well. We also assume that on release that those inmates simply wouldn't just walk back to the community with no supervision. So you'll note on line, the line below pharmacy operations with community corrections, an actual increase of $15 million, not a decrease. That assumes the current community corrections rate for those inmates being released back out into the community who would then need some sort of community supervision. And so in achieving this 10% reduction model, we actually included the costs associated with the increased burden of community corrections as those people would be moved back out to community. You see the reduction as well in the physical plant side. Summon with respect to offender information. The next largest area that you see impacted, obviously, is the $13 million associated with institutional administration and support. That's essentially the administration function that's performed at those facilities and the support functions associated with the operation of those four facilities that would be closed and the ones that would not be opened under the reduction scenario. As you move down, you'll notice that a reduction in both inmate work programs and the institutional social services programs, which are the counseling and related programs, dropping off as well. And then obviously the savings associated with the capital construction program is a $13 million piece down towards the bottom, which comes from not going forward, obviously, with the construction of those new facilities and the associated debt service and other costs of moving forward. So that's essentially the impacts associated with what it would mean to try to achieve those savings. You asked specifically if there are areas where efficiencies, for example, could be identified. We believe in the process of building the budget that we built, which included a number of policy option packages, which the governor did not include in his recommended budget, that we are operating, and I just mean this in all frankness, with a fairly lean operation. There were a number of areas that we pursued where we thought, good management of the operation would require additional services for example, with respect to dental health, mental health, and other areas, which just simply given the confines of the budget could not be supported or included as part of the recommended budget. You'll see areas of reduction in other areas as it relates to things like adult basic education, for example, and other programs. As you get into the program side, as I mentioned, it's literally less than 3% of the overall department budget. Some of those programs are actually mandated and can't be reduced down to zero. But the challenge, obviously, with forcing additional program reductions in the budget when the program component is so small, is any effect that we are trying to have with respect to reducing recidivism and transitioning people, these people effectively back to community upon release is obviously significantly impacted. No more so probably as clearly in the drug and alcohol treatment area as anywhere else in the system. Also, with the loss of the inmate work programs, as you see those reflected here as a result of the reductions, you do lose some of the value of those services that are being provided out into the community. The contracts that we have with the Forest Service, with the Park Service, the city of Salem and various other communities around the state who have, for their own purposes, begun to rely on those inmate crews to provide some services and lowering the overall cost to the taxpayer in the provision of those services would be impacted as well. So I think that this at least gives you the department's thinking about how we would go forward and prioritize. I would like to tell you there is no science to it. The priorities that we establish in each of the functional portions, which are on your long sheets in that, in my mind are perhaps more reflective of how we prioritize within each of these general broad categories. The big sheet, although it's convenient to see everything listed in one place, I would just tell you I don't think is a terribly effective tool in sort of making determinations. I think it would be difficult, for example, to simply say, well, we're going to fund everything up to line 27, but nothing below line 27. In the way the agency currently operates and the services that it provides, I think that's not a terribly effective manner in which to make the kinds of choices that we're going to be all forced to make. But with that, I'd be pleased to answer any additional questions you might have about either the long sheet presentation of this material or the big sheet that you have in front of you.
Chairman?
Yes. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Williams, we've been through this with other committees, and so I guess, first of all, I'd say, thanks for putting the work into the project, because it is a major task. I tend to agree with Representative Wisnett on the debt service portion of how you prioritize, because at my house, you can't live in it unless you make the payment. And I think there's a lot to be said. You can't be in those facilities without making the payment either. But if I was to write out in the margin if I was to look at this and I say, what were the criteria you used to do the priority ranking, I'd probably kind of look down at the first one and say, inmate hunger that was a major factor because it's the number one ranked item, yet it's a fairly small portion of the budget. Then to the security and housing. So help me identify those factors that you prioritized on, just in bullet points, if you could.
And I'd be pleased to. And I'd reference again the committee to the long sheets that are provided to you. The very front sheet essentially is an identification of the criteria that we did use, tied back to the mission and our business strategy under the Oregon Accountability Model. And then as you see, the fulfill mandates of the Oregon Constitution, federal law, state law, and others are listed there. That was the overall criteria. And then as you look at each of those individual subsections, you'll see, for example, document criteria used to prioritize activities. And what you have is institution food service, the description, provision of mail, meals to inmates, and then the criteria that we use, federal law, Oregon Constitution, state law, inmate management tools. And that's described to some degree at each level for those determinations all the way through the process. The broader criteria, I think, is we were talking about how you would somehow break these into individual program unit or service delivery chunks in a way that made some sense and allowed you some picture of how the department operated, and then to prioritize them. You know, is food more important than housing, more important than medical? You know, all of them are obligations that we have, and so to put one as a rank number one and one as a rank number two really to some degree became arbitrary in our discussions. Most of the people would tell you that, you know, I remember the old, was it the Napoleon comment about that the army, an army runs on its stomach. I would tell you that food service and the delivery of quality, healthy and plentiful food within an institution has a lot to do with how happy, contented, and functionally operating your operation is. If food service starts to decline, disappear, or become spotty, other problems ultimately erupt. It's something that I've certainly learned in the last 13 months of my involvement with the Department of Corrections. But there are several things that you know that for the operations of your facility, you try very carefully not to disrupt in a way that would cause you additional challenges. One is food service. One is the opportunity for inmates to have their visits with their family members. And the third is the provision of appropriate medical and health services. And with those in mind, you see that the food, housing, and health services are sort of identified at the top, because to rank one above the other is frankly just arbitrary. And that's, in all honesty and candor, members of the committee, where for at least what it is we do as an agency, certainly within certain program areas, you might be able to get to where these rankings make a difference. But as an agency, it becomes very difficult to assign a 1 or a 2 or a 3 to any particular category of operation of the delivery of service.
Can I follow up? That's, I think, a good answer, too, and the detail to some of this is great. My second question is just how line or priority item 26 and 32, can you tie those two together for me if they do tie together? They both look similar, and I just want to understand them.
I'll do my best and see if I get it right after I've said what I've said. I'll look over my shoulder and see if the certified detailed people. But if you'll notice, both of those, the inmate welfare subsidy, and if you look at the inmate welfare institution inmate welfare fund. Was that the reference you had?
Correct.
26 and 32?
Yes.
Within the system, as inmates purchase, as they earn their PRAS awards, which is the non-monetary compensation component, the award for their work, as those PRAS awards then are converted into the award amount, they are entitled to buy certain items off of the inmate canteen or the commissary, essentially, and pre-approved items. There is a small amount removed from those, both the awards and the sales, that are categorized into the inmate welfare fund, that are turned around then to use to fund certain of the operations of the system, them contributing essentially to the cost of their care and to programs. So even in areas like drug and alcohol treatment, you'll notice that only $500,000 of that is general fund funded on line number 5, but other funds accounts for $4.6 million of our drug and alcohol treatment. A substantial amount of that comes from the inmate welfare fund, where they're essentially funding their own treatment in the process. Similarly, the inmate welfare subsidy, the subsidy amount, is an amount that is, as I recall, given to inmates who are transitioning out who may need some additional funds upon release. Am I right about that, Sue? So it's money that runs through community corrections that is then distributed to the offenders who are releasing out to provide them that subsidy for sort of getting off the ground. And you can see it's a fairly limited amount of money given the number of offenders who are releasing. But that the community corrections, local communities control the amount of the subsidy that's distributed, and those funds are handled at the community correction level. If you look down then to line number 32, the inmate welfare fund, which is the $1.6 million, those resources, you may have to help me out again on this one, Sue, as to how those, the category of purchases with that money. Okay, so I'll repeat on the record what she just said. Those are funds that are used at the discretion of the superintendents within the institutions, again, for providing inmate-related activities or programs. And if you're interested, I'm sure we can give you a fuller breakdown of how those are used. But it provides the superintendent, along with working with the inmates, a way to determine if there's something particular, whether it's paying for a particular kind of a program or activity that would be institution specific.
Mr. Wilson, have
a and question. Sue, correct me if I'm wrong, but the use of the inmate welfare is governed by statute, and so much has to be used within the institutions, and so much has to be used outside of the institutions for the benefit of the inmates or as they are released. Am I right on that?
Come on up here, sir. We got on this extra chair because we knew that by today I wouldn't be able to get through these questions on my own.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Sue Acuff, Department of Corrections. And the statute does identify that the required use of those funds is for the benefit of the inmates. Percentages are not included. But
okay.
Please proceed.
This was as much as I intended, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to do with respect to the both the priority listing and the discussion about the 10% reduction exercise. If there are additional committee questions, be pleased to take those now, or if there are specific things that you'd like us to provide you at a future time, we'd be happy to do that as well.
I just had one question, actually. The agency-wide overhead... are those the DAS charges?
Can you refer to me to the number?
Actually, he does. I'll pay him later.
This one right here. Mr. Chairman, I believe the answer is those are generally the charges that we are required to pay for the Department of Administrative Services for various.
Can I find out how much your increase was this time?
And Mr. Chairman, I think I can direct you back. If you would look at the documents that we did spend some time reviewing yesterday on the budget piece. In our phase one materials, you'll find, I think, on this large sheet, which is on page 21 of your materials.
It would be in a previous tab.
It would be in the previous tab, right.
Under the agency.
Under the agency overview tab.
Yeah. You're talking about in the front of the binder, right?
Yeah.
21.
This is right. It's a $6.1 million increase in state government service charges. With a total, the DAS service charge is 1.8, an IRMD service charge of, the liability insurance is 1.1 million, our workers' comp assessment is 2.4 million, payroll warrants and SFMS fee is about $695,000. There's some other small charges that I didn't, capital planning charge and a state library charge and some other assessments that I didn't identify, but I gave you the large ones. Okay. But it's a $6.1 million increase for the biennial budget.
Okay. And although there may be justifications for it, it's Well, if it's 6.1, it means that it's probably roughly a 35% increase from previous biennium.
In the 2003-05 budget, in the 2003-05 budget, Mr. Chairman, the total amount was $13,550. And now it's that plus 6.1.
Okay.
So not quite a 50% increase.
Okay. I'm talking to Senator Johnson about gas increases. Representative Cannon and Mr. Wilson.
Appreciate you answering these things, but it's, we got to get our hands around it again.
I agree. I'm happy to.
The ranking item number 23, Transitional Service Administration, as it relates to item number 30, or ranking item number 34, Transition and Release. Maybe give us a little information about the transitional services, and I'm kind of, this I'm just taking a little bit further. If you look just above transition and release, the activities, and I'm assuming that's activities within the facilities, is a whole bunch more money than transition and release. And given that, and we've talked about recidivism and so on, it makes me wonder, you know, the priority level of those items.
Yeah, please.
The transition services admin, I believe, is the first reference that you made.
Yes.
$1.46 million. That truly is the administrative structure for the transitional services unit. The next item there, the transition and release of $625,000 general fund, that portion is money which is going out for assistance to those who are transitioning.
Can you help me with that? I mean, is that you give them some kind of a stipend the day they leave, or is that what that is, or is it a place to live for a few days?
Yes.
I don't know. I'm not.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it can be both. There's a limited amount of money. I believe it's, I want to say $25, which is very minimal, which have been used for that purpose. Just recently, they have been identifying some who have more of a need, and they can have some direct housing for a short period of time that can be used with that. Generally, those are the latter is associated with the alternative incarceration program, because those folks are getting a chance of success.
And if I could comment again just on the item 23, the Transitional Services Administration. The Transitional Services Division, as you recall, does not just include just the transition component, but it's also all of the other parts of that division and the operating infrastructure associated with the rest of that division, which included the offender information sentence calculation unit, the community corrections unit, and all the rest of the administration associated with that division. And that's probably why you see on the ranking that the management of the rest of those functions still requires some amount of administration, and why that got ranked above the actual delivery of that smaller amount of transitional services dollars that would be going out to the individual offender. It gets us back again to that conversation about the limited amount of resource that we have to do that kind of programming in the scope of the overall budget. And I can assure you it's not a lack of agency focus or commitment about the importance of that. But when forced to have to go through this process, the tendency to fall back to the issue associated, you know, most closely with the public safety discussion of continuing to operate institutions and keep those individuals who have been sentenced to custody in custody is the result of sort of how these rankings end up getting put together.
Ask about transport.
Yes. Representative Hanson and Mr. Wilson have a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions in that general subject matter. I'm very concerned after the visit to Coffee Creek concerning transition of mentally ill inmates, as they, I think,
their struggles are significantly more than some of our other population, mm-hmm. and transitioning until they're eligible for federal benefits, I think, is a real issue that we're going to have to discuss both in this committee and possibly in Human Resources or Human Services sub. The other area that intrigues me is, especially in light of the fact that we have 24% roughly mentally ill people in the male population, I'm wondering, is there any linkage between Department of Corrections and Veteran Services, that I'm assuming some of those people would be veterans, that we might be able to secure veterans benefits for upon their release?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen. With respect to the comment involving veterans within the department, the department has already been pleased this session to appear in front of the Committee on Veterans Affairs to discuss our veterans population that are currently incarcerated, and to talk about the various ways that we work with the Department of Veterans Services here in Oregon to determine how to best provide housing, health, and mental health care for releasing veterans. As part of the overall transition discussion, we have expanded our Transitional Services Steering Committee in the department to include representatives from the Department of Human Services, Employment, Housing and Community Services, Veterans, and others to participate in those discussions with us, primarily around this very issue. We recognized, and I certainly have recognized, and I'm sure you have as well, in thinking about the system-wide approach to these issues, that the Department of Corrections has a limited amount of ability to impact the lives of these offenders upon their release, and they end up being reliant on a number of our sister state agencies to help provide those other stability services associated with effective transition, and we have now tried to include them in our long-term planning for being more effective. And I think we've got some successful examples, both on the high-need mental health inmates, where we do a fair amount of planning with the county where those individuals are being released back to with respect to where this individual is going to live and get treatment, but also with our veterans and what potential services are going to be available. There are certain grant streams from the federal government with respect to housing that are specific to veterans, and we're working with them on enhancing what I think is already a well-focused effort in that area, but enhancing that as we move forward.
We'll be real interested in seeing how that works and if there's ways that we can help. My big concern, one of my concerns, is that if there are services available and people are eligible for these services, and if there's just that transition gap between when they come out of our institutions and when they start to receive those services, that's the most important critical time, and we as a system ought to be able to make sure that they don't fail because of needs during that gap in service delivery that for most cases is simply an administrative gap. It's not that they're not eligible for the services or the services aren't needed. It's just getting them in line to receive.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, as I'm sure you're aware, some of those issues are driven by the access to the federal program and limited and by federal law, which sometimes creates the problem as to how quickly someone who has been an incarcerated individual can get access to those programs. But we are, our plan and the effort has been from a transition planning standpoint, strategically within the department, to broaden those conversations out to other providers in a way to lessen the current fragmentation that exists when someone comes out. We take a group of people who, by the data, would reflect that a number of them, struggle cognitively. Those obviously with mental health need, those with drug addiction need, and upon release, and I would tell you that it's it's pretty challenging. I think many of us would be challenged to then say, and here are the 18 different places you have to go to attempt to achieve services to try to keep yourself stable, along with, you know, checking in with your PO and getting that registration and then going to DHS and filling out those forms and then going, and you start making that list of places where people have to go. And I think a lot of people who haven't, who aren't as cognitively challenged and haven't served time in an institution would also struggle to make sure that they were getting all that done. And so that issue of not having it be as fragmented and working strategically with respect to this population as they're releasing back out in the community is one of our overarching objectives as we, you know, continue to move our transitional services component forward.
And financing it with a $25 bill. You
know. Yeah.
Wilson has a question.
No, I didn't have a question. I was just going to make a comment to a couple topics ago, and that was the overhead, agency-wide overhead. Keep in mind that there was a $6.1 billion increase. I think over half that increase was in the liability and workers' comp insurance or coverage, not really insurance. Keep in mind that part of that is not necessarily due to DAS's rates going up. Part of it is based on agency experience in terms of claims, either liability or workers' comp claims. So keep that in mind. It can contribute a lot. A large settlement can hit you for a number of biennia.
I think I believe that I asked for, if I didn't, I would ask for it now, and that the history of the workers' comp claims, the frequency, because the safety issue of our employees is also extremely important. And, you know, I know I've asked the same within the state hospital. So I would like, you know, if you could have that for us to give us some historical data, you know, and not just for this fiscal year, but go back so we can see what the trend lines look like.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that your request was heard, and I know they're preparing that data for you. I think we have a report. They're making sure that it reflects several biennia so you can see the trend, and we'll be pleased to provide it to you and the other members of the committee.
Well, we did an excellent tour of Coffee Creek, and we looked at that model, but I'm also aware that not all models fit that particular mode, and staffing patterns are different, and making certain that you that staff are in a place where they're too safe is critical. Particularly, I'm thinking of the facility that's pretty antiquated, that doesn't have the same kind of visuals and doesn't have the same kind of high-tech equipment that we saw when we went to Coffee Creek. And so,
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I know that Senator Lordley at one point had thought as well that the committee might wish to take a tour of the state penitentiary, which is just down the street, and we'd be pleased to arrange a tour either collectively or separately for any of you who would like to see it when the time is appropriate.
Different clanging of the doors.
Any additional, Senator Winters?
No, I just... If you see one facility, all facilities don't look like it. And it is, I think, a critical issue of protection of staff. You know, we don't always look into staff ratios, and we see one facility, and that requires one staffing pattern, and you go to another facility, it may require something totally different.
Chairman?
Yes. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What's that? I'm going to get this straight with Mama.
Dan has both of us in the other meeting. Director Williams, I think it might have been before the chair came in. This is all very helpful, but I think if we're going to recommend to you and you're going to recommend to the co-chairs, the senator, of any reduction.
Mr. Gordley is actually going to make the recommendation. So.
You said for 10% because you've done this all this work, but really, you know, if you have to do a 10% cut, you'd have to close the facility, let 1,800 inmates out in July and 400 inmates out in September. What would you do as a manager if you had to do a 5% cut? You know, can Can you leave the facilities open? We're getting 900 new inmates a year in. You're proposing, I guess, that there's 2,200 that we could put on the streets with minimum risk or some risk. How would you do a 5% cut? You mean, you still have to close the facility and delay the opening of the other two?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to clarify first that I didn't make a risk assessment about the risk of those inmates were we to release them. We would certainly strive as much as we could to identify, if we were actually forced to go down this path, those who we believe to be the least risk to the community based on a number of factors, some related to nearness to release, others simply related to crime category and activity. So we would make our very best efforts, but you know, I think it's incumbent upon me to put on the record that there isn't a, you know, there would not be a guarantee about the risk associated with those decisions from the department. With respect to a 5% reduction, I would tell you that I think that it would still require some impact on operations and population within the system. Would it be taking the 10% reduction and cutting it in half and only closing two as opposed to four of the institutions that we identified? I think that it would be something more akin to that, or not opening the late view and not going forward with the Madras build out, recognizing that also has an impact on the incoming population that's projected over the next biennia, and that there are costs associated with if you don't open those. You have to assume that you are going to be taking the inmates that have that higher risk that you have to have in, and matrixing out another inmate from the population standpoint who has low risk, who you're ready to release now because you don't have that bed space available. And this assumes the non-opening of those facilities, and also assumes that you are not paying the cost of the associated rental beds to meet that population. So it would a 5% reduction would still require some adjustment in the population numbers and the management. And I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Sue, but I think it takes us still down that path to some degree.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I want to take you back for just a minute to page 17 for the overview.
Yes.
And just that one little paragraph there was intended to, I think, set the stage for the flexibility and the non-flexibility within the department. Just the operations division, the transition services division, and debt service, if you consider all of those pieces, just those pieces, and that would include your community corrections grants and programs, that's about 91.5% of the budget. That leaves only 8.5% where there's really the flexibility where you're not having to deal with that incoming population either coming in or going out. And that 8.5% equates to $91.4 million. And that has to cover all of HR. The human resources activities, all the information systems, your business functions, your admin, and your capital improvements. So all of those things where you might have a little bit of flexibility in what you deal with, it's a very, very small percentage of the budget. And it's to take 5% from that would wipe out basically your infrastructure, and the DOC could not operate without that. So that's kind of a different way to look at if you need to take a further 5% reduction. I believe that, yes, you would have to go to an institution closure in order to reach that number.
You want a 5%?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't find it, Director Williams or Sue, but last year you delayed filling vacancies for 60 days, and that saved $11 million or something. Is that correct? So.
Yeah.
Instead of refilling them immediately versus was it 60 days or 45 days?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wisnant, essentially all state agencies were directed to do a delay on vacancies of, I believe it was a 30-day delay, and we were under that as well. In addition to that 30-day delay, we were told to identify and make real an additional $11 million of vacancy savings on top of our 30-day vacancy delay, which we did. And it did produce $11 million in net savings as a result of holding those positions vacant. But again, the $11 million gets you about 1% of where you'd want to go, and the costs associated with those vacancies, there's an offset, a downstream offset cost associated with having filled those vacancies, and so some of the challenge associated with that comes back to us in the way of
overtime,
burnout, sick leave usage, and a variety of other areas, which I know at some point in the more detailed presentations we'll be able to talk to the committee about. And I believe it was one of the reasons why the governor funded back that $11 million forced vacancy. It also affects because not all vacancies are equal. So to achieve some of that $11 million vacancy, it required us to hold some of our more expensive health provider positions open, and again, to meet our constitutional and statutory obligations about delivery of services, you can only hold some of those positions open so long without at some point putting other issues at risk within the system and increasing the department's overall liability. If I could, I'd follow up briefly on just the comment that Ms. Acuff made about the overhead or the administration portion, which does include the HR and our information systems and all of the business functions and the general services functions that we've talked briefly about, that really only account for 8.5% of the remaining portion of the budget. That also includes all of the oversight function. It's the function that includes our Inspector General's office. It's the function that includes our internal audits unit. It's the functions that include our fiscal operations. The fact that we have to actually follow the money, balance the books, make sure that we're spending on the things that we're supposed to be spending on. It includes those functions that look into the operations of the agency to determine whether or not we're following procedure and practice and ensuring the safe and fair and humane treatment of the people who've been assigned to us. And I understand at times the desire to look to those kinds of administrative places as a place to make reduction, because it's not the delivery necessarily of the mainline service that an agency delivers. At the same time, I think we see sort of the natural reaction whenever something then happens on the ground level that eventually creates a hue and cry in an agency. People are quick to jump back to the question of, well, who was watching that? Where was that, where was the management infrastructure to be keeping an eye on that situation? Who failed as a result of watching this issue, whether it was the outcome of an audit, whether it was a real unfortunate situation involving some kind of a juvenile? We roll naturally back to that question, and I would tell you that the places where those things are happening, where those structures provide the level of oversight that both the public and the legislature want, they fall into those categories of those administrative overhead expenses. They are the finance offices. They are the Inspector General's offices. They are those management positions managing the right number of people in a way to ensure that policy and procedure and practice is being followed. So I feel like I've got to at least put on the record that those are the building blocks that keep the agency actually operating as a system. Were those to go away, what you'd really be left with was 13 independent operating prisons with no oversight and no central control of any of those functions, which over the long term has proven to be a much more cost-effective approach.
Mr. Wilson.
Just one more thing, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Williams. The 10% reduction contemplates releasing or not bringing in inmates, like 1,800 plus or whatever number. I don't think that the agency right now does not have the authority to release those folks. There would have to be statutory changes made or very complicated other ways of doing it, which probably are not workable.
But Mr. Chair and Mr. Wilson, that's accurate. We do not have release authority. It is not something that's been granted to the director of the department to release. So it would require statutory change.
Follow up on that, is over what period of time would you have to release those 1,800?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, in order to achieve the 10% reduction, the 1,800 would have to be released on, it assumes, these numbers assume a July 1, 05 release date. And then it would mean sort of a perpetual release to offset the incoming people who would otherwise be housed in either rental beds or at Madras or the Warner Creek facility, which it also assumes would not operate. So as those 1,000 or so, 900 or so that Sue Porter talked to you about on the upcoming population forecast, as those new people were sentenced to us, we would have to have release authority for a like number over the biennia who would essentially drop out to make a space available for those individuals coming in.
Yes, Senator Winters.
Other states, I mean, in fact, states across this country are faced with the same issue and budget problems that we're faced with. What are some of the strategies that they're using in, let's say, like California and our neighboring state to the north?
To the north, there.
They're
putting them 3 to a cell.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, interestingly enough, there are other states that are experiencing a growth in population that is perhaps comparable. There are not very many that have a population that is growing at the rate that Oregon has. Some states have actually recently experienced a decrease in their actual population, and I'm aware of several states who have seen that impact and decrease. What I would tell you is that
which states are those, Mr. Williams? We're looking for rental beds.
And I would have to go back to my list to tell you specifically, Senator, as to the states that have seen the reduction. But you have seen a number of states in the last couple of years review their sentencing policy and practice and to make changes in those sentence policy and practices and to roll back some of their mandatory sentencing. But I have to be quick to point out the distinction between Oregon and those other states. Most of those states who have made changes, including the state of Washington with respect to its sentencing policy, have done so with respect to mandatory sentences which they had imposed on drug offenders. Oregon did not impose mandatory minimum sentences on drug offenders. Many of those systems saw substantial increases in their population because of mandatory minimums with respect to drug offenses, and then over time have decided as a matter of policy and practice to step back away from those mandatory minimum sentences. And there are several reports which we could be pleased to provide the committee about the various states that have made those changes to their sentencing policy. Oregon's mandatory minimum sentences are prison crimes. They're the serious violent offenses that have been identified under Ballot Measure 11 and as a result are different in a type and nature than those mandatory drug sentences that other states had adopted. So it creates, I think, a wrinkle in the question to some degree of being able to compare us to some of the other states that have recently gone through sentencing reform because it's just a different kind of sentence, and I think there's a different kind of perception on the part of both public and policymaker about those kinds of reductions. But that's frankly how some of the other states who have gone on a similar kind of expansion have managed their reduction.
Another factor in making your projections is if you look at that Oregon, not only the mandatory sentencing, but looking at Oregon as becoming a very geriatric state, and when you did those particular projections, you get tired and so your energy level isn't the same when you're talking about the criminal behavior. So, when you made the projections of what we can look out into the future, was that factored in the aging population issue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, those issues are considered as part of the forecasting that's done by the Department of Administrative Services, Office of Economic Analysis. They look at both the age, crime category, and crime type of the population. I can't begin to describe the science necessarily that Ms. Porter uses in the preparation of those documents, but I know that her model assumes those issues. That being said, and I'll allow Ms. Gilbert to talk maybe more about that. That being said, there is an increasing number. Currently, the department has 432 inmates who are over the age of 61, and that number will grow substantially over the next biennia or two. So we are having an enhanced number of individuals incarcerated who are over the age of 61, and that creates with it some issues. What we've learned about crime to some degree is we know that certain kinds of crimes people do age out of. Theft, robbery, even some of the violent offenses, traditionally, as a person ages, they are less likely to reoffend. If the committee will recall, about a third of our population, slightly less than a third of our population, are sex offenders, and what we've been able to learn about age with respect to sex offenders is that that's typically a behavior that people don't age out of. And so there are again complexities, I think, in each of these conversations as one considers the nature of the population.
Do you have a graph to show us based on projected forecast and actual, someplace that we'll get later on in the presentation? Somewhere in all this volume of stuff.
And I apologize, Madam, Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters. I was anticipating another question, so can you ask me yours again, and I'll give you a clearer answer.
I was talking about forecasting, and we know that you're always in this building when we forecast revenue, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's what actually occurs. And, you know, so I'm just saying, do you have any historical data when we do the forecasting and projection? And I'm sure that you participate in this. Nodding up and down, but yes, in fact, you do.
Sure, and we do, and I would comment as well that on the opening day on Monday, as Ms. Porter went through her materials, she was able to demonstrate that in the I think it's the last three biennia, at the time that the forecast was made, the session forecast, which comes out in March, she's been, I think the forecast has been less than 1% off of the projection and the accurate, the current population numbers.
Yeah. Senator Winters, I think where a lot of the speculation about the forecast comes, to be honest, is the early forecast, both directly before Measure 11 and the ones directly after Measure 11, that were considerably way off at that time. I think since the time that she reported on Monday, since 97 forward, they've been relatively on target. In fact, we wish our revenue forecast had been as on target.
Maybe we should make
they're good at inmate populations and not at corporate.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, what I recall about those early forecasts were that there was nothing by which to gauge the reaction with respect to Measure 11, with respect to both the actions of the courts and how that people would be charged by the district attorneys. And so it took a certain amount of experience. One assumes that sort of everybody would have been treated sort of to the fullest extent. And what I think it did was it took some experience of actually seeing how it worked in practice for the Office of Economic Analysis to develop enough of an understanding of the system to then to begin accurately predicting sentence length and number of offenders and the like.
Yes, Representative Hamm.
This is for Doug mainly, and maybe to these folks as well, but this format, is this available in an Excel spreadsheet format? I mean, do you have this on Excel?
The columns and things?
Yeah,
we do.
In an Excel spreadsheet.
We send it off to agencies to fill in, so.
I got to tell you, I look through this whole thing, and I know we don't have the experience at it, but it's disappointing to me to hear that we would have to close facilities by, you know, when we talk about it, I mean, and Representative Wisnett said, well, what if you went to a 5%? Can you make it work then? And I guess I would hope that you would be open to
because I think we're going to sit at this table, and though it's hard to put things in order and it's difficult to assign ranking to it, our chairs of the full Ways and Means, that's what they're asking us to come back and say is, how would you do this? So I'd love to be able to look at the spreadsheet version of this that we could, I use the term loosely, play with the numbers. In other words, I mean, I'm looking at it from I hope, but the best I can from your eyes, food and housing and health services and so on. But as I go through the list and I massage and look at all the numbers, I do look at a lot of the things like the activities and the canteens and the institutional welfare funds. And can we revisit? Can we have conversation about that and say, thank you for your input. Here's how you do it. And let us take a swing at that and say, what about this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, that's obviously the position that you're in. And our job, I think, is to provide you the most salient...
Yeah, half the committee wanted to ask you a question, but please proceed, Mr. Williams.
That's obviously the most, we're going to provide you the most salient and accurate information that we can provide, and we'd be pleased to give you this sheet on an Excel spreadsheet that that you're welcome to play with and have conversations with you about what each of these very abbreviated categories actually includes. About the fund source, as one goes down that road, I'd remind that other funds is different than general fund, and some of the other funds, money, for example, in the inmate welfare fund, you don't get if you don't have a canteen, and there are those kinds of issues that you have to have conversations about as they interrelate with each other. But we'd be pleased to have those conversations with the committee over time.
Representative Hansen and Senator Winters, and then I'll ask a question after those.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This cut package, the premise behind it is closing four, or either closing or not operating four institutions. What I would find very helpful, I mean, that's I think within the constraints of what you need to bring us for this 10% cut package, that's probably, I think, all you could do. Although that does require legislative change in order to allow you to do that, what would be some other scenarios that would get us to that type of a reduction? And I'm thinking changes in sentencing practices for people coming into the institutions. We've got constitutional mandates with Measure 11. We've got constitutional mandates with capital punishment. We've got constitutional mandate with inmate work that we don't get to the total goal. So I'm wondering, what would some other scenarios to reach this type of a reduction on things like if we had no jail time for people with convicted of controlled substances, or I don't know all of the ramifications, but if the district attorneys were changing their charging practices, or are there other scenarios that we could get to this same thing without going through the exercise of can we reduce calorie intake by 200 calories a day, or minimizing work crews, or these kind of little operation.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, and we'll think about some other alternatives that we can provide you. The one that obviously gets the most play is the discussion about a reduction in sentences. And as I've said several times already before this committee and some of the joint committees, I think that a review of smart and intelligent sentencing policy and practice is an important issue that this legislature ought to examine. I think it's a good conversation to have, both from a policy and a practical standpoint. I would tell you that you get very little savings out of sentence changes in this biennium unless you intend to make them retroactive and have immediate release. Changes to Measure 11, for example, if you were going to make them prospectively, because the minimum Measure 11 sentence is 70 months, you don't start seeing a difference if you were going to give someone, for example, earned time on Measure 11. You wouldn't start to see the impact on that until someone had served 80% of the 70-month sentence, which extends it out obviously a few years before you start to see the impact. None of that is to suggest or to dissuade you from considering and having those conversations, because I think in the long run, those are policy choices, given Ms. Porter's forecast and the impact on the long-term impact on the state's general fund, that are worthy conversations for this body to engage in. But I'm cautious to make sure that people understand that immediate changes in sentencing have very little impact. I can tell you in this biennium, were you to increase earn time for non-Measure 11 offenders, if you were to take all the non-Measure 11 offenders we have in the system and you were to take their earn time allocation from the 20% they currently receive to 30%, that change alone in earn time for all the offenders we have in the system that are non-Measure 11 offenders would have about a $1 million savings impact on the biennial budget. So very small adjustments in the immediate impact. Over time, on all of these, those changes begin to demonstrate larger and larger savings over the history of the system. But the immediate impact of some of those changes would be very, very small indeed, unless one were to make them retroactive in application, which would result again in that immediate release conversation that we've had this afternoon.
Follow-up comment on that. One of the huge problem with closing the four institutions or not operating them and creating an immediate release is what that does to credibility of sentencing and credibility of the system. So if we look at earned good time, whether it be Measure 11 or expanding, how we implement some of the other changes might have less impact on the credibility of the sentencing. And I think obviously it's something we've got to discuss. The other aspect is if we take a little longer term view. Yeah, there's no question there's not a lot of impact in the next 2 years. But in terms of how we're allocating resources, if we're looking over the next 3 to 5 biennium, we have to make the changes now. And again, what's the impact of credibility over that period? If we knew that there was going to be if we knew there were going to be savings in the future, it might be easier to justify to the public fully funding this corrections program during this biennium, knowing that there were going to be increased savings on down the road. But we don't have any real easy, simple choices, it would appear.
Senator Winters, and then I'll have a question.
Rick Hansen took the direction that I was going to go, so I don't need to ask my question.
I was going to ask you a really tough question, but I'll ask that outside the room. I'll ask you a softball.
don't hold back, Senator Devlin.
You want the tough question?
Whatever the senator pleases.
Forecast in March doesn't show what we anticipate it shows. We anticipate maybe a 40 million upclick, 40, 50 million upclick. Tiny in terms of proportion of forecast. Goes the other direction. Shows a quarter of a billion dollar fall. Governor says he can only take another 100 million out of K through 12. and you can only take another $100 million out of human services. And $50 million has to be cut out of public safety, and you got to take $40 million of that, but they want you not to release any inmates. How do you do it?
Mr. Chairman,
this is softball.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a question I hope I never have to actually answer. But we would go through an analysis to determine whether or not we could do it. I would tell you that given our current situation, I would be hard pressed to tell you that we would. Is that $40 million? Is that a reduction in excess just off of the governor's recommended budget?
Off the governor's recommended budget.
We can go back and look and tell you what we would do if you want us to go through that analysis, Senator.
I'll give you a different number actually to go back for, but. The thing here, I think, important for the committee to understand, this is not necessarily an adversarial process. It's not an adversarial process. It's not the process that Mr. Williams is used to in his former life. Not as a legislator, but as an attorney.
Yeah, thank you for the qualification.
But he presented a budget, his department presented a budget to the governor. I don't know what was within that budget, and I don't know what the governor rejected that was in that budget in terms of a request. The budget's presented to us. Mr. Williams is a representative of the executive branch. He has to defend the governor's budget. He has to provide us the information that we ask for. The budget management analyst person to my right has to defend the governor's budget also. Mr. Wilson has to look for whatever he can find within the budget that he thinks might be questionable, and so do we. And sooner or later, I believe we're going to be asked to find some reductions in the corrections budget. And it'll be a lengthy process. So that's what I don't expect. That it's going to be much easier than it's been here today.
No, I nor would I.
So, I do have my softball now, and this is not an area that I'm looking to cut, necessarily. So don't look at it as a potential cut. If I went into your department that has 70 FTE and 66 people, where we were the other day, in terms of inmate records, would I be walking into a records area from the 1980s, or would I be walking into a records area from 2005?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would tell you that you would be walking into a records area from the 1980s or earlier.
Okay.
And I mean no disrespect to the staff who are responsible for that, because they do a tremendous job, but it is a very paper-rich environment. We spend a fair amount of time collecting the information from arresting agencies, from county jails, the various records, medical, mental health, and others that eventually get assembled into that inmate record that is kept there. We're also under obligation to keep a duplicate file of that record there, as well as with the inmate at the institution where the inmate is housed. So that information is accessible, obviously, for various management purposes where that inmate is. We also are required to provide to the archives copies of that material as well at the appropriate time. That includes microfishing some of that, and as we move more into document imaging, which is the process that is now coming online, which will move it up a little bit in the age of the records analysis, it's getting better. But I would tell you, our ability to have a paperless record for an inmate as they move through the system doesn't exist, in part because our own offender information system, our CIS system that we have within the department, is an old COBOL-based computer program that is held together by several very smart and nearing retirement staff members who keep it operating for us. And that was one of the things that was included in our recommendation to the budget, which did not make it as we went through the prioritization, and the governor's office and DAS went through the prioritization of budget preparation.
The reason I ask the question is because because of those recommendations in the governor's budget, and because, you know, if you go away from some of the other issues like that I think Senator Winters most often deals with in terms of, like, medical records issues and
going to paperless systems and going to so that all providers know what care is being provided to someone, and there are huge confidentiality issues in those areas, and there are some in this area.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole criminal justice system, in terms of records being easily accessible to agencies, still respecting where confidentiality has to be respected, but still living 30 years in the past, is, I think, a huge problem, particularly when you get somebody. Now, you may know within a relatively short period of time, but when you get somebody at the institution in intake, when you don't really have a very clear picture, unless they are a ward weaver and they've been on the news, of what their criminal background is, and it seems to be something we could actually attempt to address over the next couple of biennials and do something about.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be in the long term, again, and I focus on the word long term, it would be a long term wise investment for the state to address that issue, because certainly there's a duplication of record and a duplication of service associated with it. I'd also point out, just to make sure the clarification didn't get lost, that of the people who were working in that building where we had the hearing, only some are records related. Others are the prison term analysts who are trying to determine and interpret the various judgments and time served at the counties and all the other pieces to determine what the appropriate length of sentence for those individuals are. So they're not all necessarily creating and managing records. A lot of them are doing the very technical sentence computation work that's required of us to ensure that we keep people for the right length of time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Medical and Health and Human Services, I think I'll just lay there on the table, because the same issue exists within the Department of Human Services as well. They're dealing with antiquated systems. Just as in the old Cole, and we put, it's been linked along with spit and bail, and yet the expectation is that we're able to communicate like they do at the banks and other places where you've got high tech and stuff, and it doesn't exist. I'm glad you raised that, but I didn't want you to think that it just existed in corrections and it doesn't exist in and not human services.
No, unfortunately, it exists almost in every sector of state government.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Winters, part of that obviously is because of the way we deliver services in somewhat of a fragmented fashion. Public safety is delivered by a variety of services in a variety of local governments, from local police agencies to sheriff's office to community corrections offices to the Department of Corrections, and the DAs and the courts and everyone else involved. And so it is a fragmented delivery system, which means that everybody over time developed their own systems. And much is the same you could say about the state's mental health system or any other system that DHS is managing.
Mr. Williams, at this point, I'm going to ask you what your preference is. We're about 15 or 20 minutes away from actually adjourning. We still have the very major areas of population management and the prison construction issues. Would you prefer to present those as a unified body or a unified set of issues on Monday, or is there an area of that that you want to get in today, say in the next 15 minutes?
I'm just
give a preview for Monday.
Yeah, I'm very respectful of the committee's time and the length of the conversation which we'll need to have about the department's population forecast and the construction plan. I worry we'll completely consume all our time on Monday and will not leave us sufficient time even then to respond to your questions. Knowing that this is my last opportunity to have you before Monday, and hope that maybe I can provide you some quick information that you would be maybe in a situation to ponder and consider over your 3 days before we have a chance to meet again, I'd like to talk you through just some quick information. One would be the distribution of this this book, which Doug is providing each of you. It is the Population Management Options. And I'm not going to take a lot of time to walk you through it. I'll probably spend a few minutes on it when we get together on Monday. What you have mostly in these documents is appendices to support some underlying data in what I've attempted to abbreviate down into about a 7-page discussion a textual discussion about various options that the department will have with respect to population management. And then behind that is a substantial amount of data that we've collected or been asked to collect by the Legislative Fiscal Office with respect to various issues, including the surveys of available jail beds, cost per day issues, and the like. And that's there and available for you at your perusal. In the back of the document, slid in the back pocket of the document, is a page that looks like this. And I want to identify that for your review as well. This page is a shorthand analysis of some various alternatives with respect to construction. And I'm going to not spend a lot of time on it again because of the time that we have, but it's a document that you might want to look at over your time. If you have questions about it between now and Monday that you'd like us to be prepared to answer, feel free to call or communicate those to Mr. Wilson, and we'll be prepared to respond to them. But what it reflects for you is the Madras facility, the Coffee Creek facility, the current rental bed plan, the impact of general fund costs and the construction costs to a total cost on the right-hand column. Option A is the current population management plan. Option B delays that construction for 2 years and uses in-state and out-of-state rental beds to address the population. Option C is a similar delay using in-state rental beds, including 300 beds at the Multnomah County Wapato facility. And then option 4 gives you simply, it's not really an option as much as it's a representation of some impact with respect to the reduction in costs associated with earn time. You'll see construction assumptions, the rental bed assumptions from the research that we've been able to do to provide our best set of assumptions. You'll also see DOC costs, including rental bed alternatives, and the assumptions associated with the earned time credit increase. So those are these numbers are numbers that I would like to take some time and walk you through, actually, on Monday when we get back together. I think to rush through them now would be just not terribly effective. But at the same time, I hesitate to have you noodle on it all week. If you've got questions, please call and we'll be happy to respond. Also, you have this sheet, which is a companion to this, which takes you through each of those alternatives, identifies pros and cons and the risks that the department has associated with each set of those alternatives, because as we identified those options for your consideration or those alternatives, we also felt it was appropriate to have you understand what the various trade-offs, some of them monetary, some of them non-monetary, over the period of time that those would be in conversation. Finally, I was going to ask Ms. Acuff, and perhaps she can do it in the few minutes we have left, to at least walk you briefly through as sort of the set piece for the conversation that we then hope to have with you on Monday, some general information about the long-term construction plan and capacity management plan for the department. So if you're prepared for that and you're willing to give us your attention for another few minutes, I'd ask her to do that now, and that I think would save us some time beginning in our conversation on Monday.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, there was an information that was asked for, and that was for current institutions, for current DOC institutions, to provide the completion date and occupancy date for those. I'd like to do that to you differently. This is an update of the table, and on the right-hand column is the actual page. I'm sorry, for the record, Sue Acuff, again, Department of Corrections. And what is coming around is simply another column on a chart that you've already seen, which adds a completion date or occupancy for the completed facilities that we currently operate, with exception of the last one, and we put 2005 down on Warner Creek, which will be open in September. On those couple of ones that you'll see
For example, Eastern Oregon was built in 1911. DOC actually occupied that one in 1991. That's those kinds of references. Powder River, the 1989 and 2003, that facility was expanded, so that's why the two dates, the last one in 2003. Shutter Creek, explanation there was 1950. DOC operated in 1990 and will expand and be complete in 2005.
Yeah, and on Shutter Creek, I should mention that was a former Air Force radar station that the federal government gave the state. As the new director, when I toured the facility for the very first time, I met the gentleman who is in charge of the physical facility out there, and I was commenting that I believe the state paid $1 to get the facility from the Air Force, and when I asked him about that, he looked at me and said, "We got taken." So it gives you some sense of the state of affairs of that
facility. How was the golf course?
Excuse me?
What kind of shape was the golf course in?
There was on the side of this hill. I would.
It's an Air Force base.
Yeah, there was no golf course on the. It was a small radar facility, not a slope.
That's not Air Force.
The height to the next hole would have been extremely difficult.
Okay, with that, Mr. Chair, if I might move into the long range construction plan, and I'll reference you back to when Sikora was here from BASS, and the graphic that she showed you was actually we reproduced on page 14 in the overview, and that was one that Senator Winters essentially referred to in Look at Things. That's essentially the snake. Look at the world.
Page 14 in the agency overview.
Page 14 in the agency overview.
Thank you.
In your main overview. It's that picture that DOC attempts to do its planning to every 6 months. There's a new forecast every April, October, and you see that as Ms. Porter was speaking to, that line continues to go up. And that's our dilemma, and that's the discussion when you speak to a reduction in a budget in a time of absolute growth. That is a very difficult thing to do when you don't have an opportunity for release on the other end, and you just have folks who are continually coming in. But this is what we're trying to plan to. And in doing that, just a couple of numbers for you, and now I'll take you back. Sorry for the diversion, but to your capital construction portion in that same book. One of the latter tabs.
In the old, or the former notebook?
Right.
Which one we got?
Right. The primary book.
In that, we're roughly today about 12,700 inmates. In her forecast, in Sue's forecast, by July of 2004, that grows to 17,572. That's a huge growth. And even from her estimate beginning July of 5 of 13,000 plus, in the system, that means we need to accommodate another 4,800 people. And how to do that in a system where the last biennium, our direction was, no, you're going to stop your construction plan and internally look to what you can do. The same very concern that the committee showed earlier today, how can you limit your expenditures? That was a conversation that we had 2 years ago. And essentially we did that. And we looked internally, and the accommodation that we made was to crowd to the extent we could possibly do it safely, and we added another 441 beds, and then we had to go to the rental scenario in order to accommodate even the population current biennium. So that's the background to the conversation that you need to carry now. It's not as if we're up to date and we're keeping pace on construction. We're not. We're behind now, and we are indeed needing to rent beds. So it's that picture that we start you with. And I'll take you back just one little bit. In 2002, the state of the fiscal environment actually is what precluded the sale of the certificates of participation to go on with our construction plans. In the 2001 session, we did have approval to move forward with the Shutter Creek expansion and to move forward with the Madras project. Both of them, those were ones that were stopped. The Lakeview facility was allowed to move forward at the 400 beds, and that one will come online in September. By the time of, I'll take you to the next forecast, in October of 2003, we were in trouble. And the forecast was exceeding even what it was when the previous forecast. At that time, we requested the ability to go ahead with the design of Madras and also now the Coffee Creek facility. That was a new wrinkle. The women's population earlier had not been predicted to grow as fast. And actually, it was in 2008 when it looked like we had to add the last minimum unit there. That didn't hold true. That population is coming in faster now, and that's one of the projects we're asking to move forward. Not only the 108 on the minimum side, but two of the medium units as well. So 216 on the minimum or medium side. That project and the Madras one both. We asked for design authority to move forward, and we did receive that in October of 3. The April then of 4 forecast, again, was showing greater numbers. And at that point, we did receive approval to move ahead with the Shutter Creek project. Original authority was in 2001, was stopped, then in 2004. Both the governor and the e-board gave us authority to move forward with that one. That was in June of 4. So those two projects went ahead. That's kind of just a real quick background for you. The women will give you a little bit more of an update there. Not only are we needing to build, but we are currently out of capacity, currently. And we're using temporary beds within that facility. And it may be that we need to rent up to 30 additional beds for women in local capacities by the end of this current biennium. So that is a major issue for us.
Ms. Acuff, I know this will raise obvious safety issues, but I know the one thing any corrections division does well is count inmates, as you count them all the time. Can you give me a count on Monday for the highest population that any of these facilities have had in the last decade? And if there's any significant difference in the configuration of the facility that might explain a difference, can you explain that also? I think some of those things may have occurred at the penitentiary. And I know that there are very serious safety issues associated with some of those surrounding issues, but I know that this issue is going to come up, so I'd better to put you on notice that.
Just a thought, and I'd ask Mr. Wilson if he could get it for us, because there historically there usually is a correlation between when you have high unemployment rates, that those impacts have implications for the corrections division as well as some of human services and so forth. So would you get us some trend lines on when we started the recession and when those numbers started to go up, and we're still there?
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you just, and this is a big subject, you can cut it short, it's not the appropriate time, but if I understand, I mean, you're talking about the need for 4,800 more inmates to be housed in the next 10 years. But we're really talking about building Warner Creek, Madras, Junction City, and adding on to Coffee Creek. Why not the idea of going less facilities bigger? I mean, isn't Snake River 3,000 inmates? You know, if we're talking about being efficient,
3,000 people in one place versus 400 in Lakeview and 400 here. Give us a short background on that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanna, this topic has a variety of twists and turns to it, from the politics associated with where a prison gets sited, from the practical sense of where a prison perhaps ought to get sited, to the issue of the size and scope of prisons for appropriate level prison management. The siting of these prisons of which I didn't participate in directly, with the exception of a few votes with respect to the siting, I think, of the Wilsonville facility when I was in the legislature, but the actual process of siting the prisons where the department went through a substantial process to determine where to site these prisons, that was both involved in the practical side of the issues and the political side of the issues, tied to the ultimate determinations to where the property was purchased. So, for example, Madras is property that the state owns. That's the Department of Corrections owns the property in Madras. It owns the property in Junction City. It owns the property in White City. It owns the property in Lakeview. So those are investments that the state has already made with respect to those purchases. As the state and Department of Corrections went through the substantial siting process, which was a very complicated process from a number of standpoints, the size issue has a number of factors that drives it. You could not build a big prison, a prison much bigger than the one we're building, in a community of Lakeview and support it. The prison in the Snake River facility in Ontario is, in all honesty, oversized for the community and the ability of the community to support it with respect to the job pool, the facilities associated with it, and the like, besides the fact of being a facility that's about 1,000 beds bigger than effective management can actually operate. It is difficult. The larger the facility does not necessarily control all of your costs, because you still have to have a certain level of staff to the size of the facility and a certain level of management overseeing that staff as you build that infrastructure. So there is perhaps some savings on the ground initially with respect to infrastructure build-out, but the long-term savings and the management issues associated with the size of the facility from an optimum inmate management system challenge the idea of sort of super prisons or mega prisons. There are numerous other issues we could talk about that impact it, but I think it would be clear to say that there are some people over time who have viewed the location of these prisons as an economic development methodology, and that, I think, can account for some of the location discussion that we're probably having today. Those were decisions that were made, you know, and beyond the power of the Department of Corrections, other than provide the very best information about the challenges associated with locating prisons in remote areas, from everything from transport to the delivery of services to the application pool and hiring the right people. But to some degree, that bet has been made for the department, given where we have the locations and where the state has already invested its resources in the property. I'd go on to say that in Madras, for example, which I know we'll have a chance to talk about tomorrow, we have $9 million essentially already invested in the Madras site, not including the property purchase, but in the agreements with the local water delivery, with the local community to upgrade their wastewater treatment facility, and various other infrastructure improvements that have already been made on that property. Do you have other comments? Ms. Acuff was here during most of that process and has the scholars to prove it from all the siting hearings. When I bring that topic up, there's usually a shudder that goes through most of the people at the Department of Corrections.
Perhaps Senator Winters, and then we will adjourn.
I was involved in county government at the time that we were going through this siting process and the development of 1145. After Measure 11 passed, the state, I think, did some really good planning in terms of population projections and stuff. I don't think they're seriously off from their original ones. The
They're certainly not perfect, and there's been some acceleration, and but pretty much that planning that was done during the 90s with the budget projections that the state had and stuff, I thought was good work. And 1145 came in at the same time. What I'm seeing now, though, is we've got a plan that was designed probably close to 10 years ago now. Conditions have changed dramatically in terms of the amount of revenue that the state has. I don't think we'll go back to growth like we had in the 90s in terms of revenue. I don't think that we can sustain that plan on into the future. And, I mean, we've struggled with it for the last 3 years. There are only so many efficiencies you can wring out of the system. There's no question probably we could have built into the plan some more efficiencies if we hadn't been trying to spread the population out over the whole state, which was a political decision. There were a lot of political decisions that just had to be made because of the nature of trying to site that many institutions. There's still some, for example, communities like Lakeview or Madras that step forward and say we want, would feel, I think, a real sense of betrayal in terms of going back and saying, well, yeah, you local officials that put yourself on the line to encourage us to come, now we're not going to do that after you've changed your local plans and stuff to accommodate these types of institutions. But still, I think there's some point where we have to say that we can't sustain the plan that was designed during the 90s, and what do we do instead? And that's a discussion that sooner or later we're going to have to get into. And because each biennium, I don't think we can go through and have the same discussion over again. How do we provide for this type of a correction system with the types of revenue that we have without cannibalizing a lot of other things that the state of Oregon does? And it's going to be a wonderful political decision.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, it does lead me back to a comment that Representative Hanna, I think, artfully made yesterday in a discussion where he correctly described us as we don't control the tap, but we're underneath it with the bucket. And, you know, we're telling you that the bucket's out of room and you got a couple of choices about how you handle what's coming into the bucket. But if you want to let the flow continue as it currently is, and even if you start turning off the tap now, the water's continuing to flow in the bucket, you got to decide how big you want the bucket to be. And we're here to provide you as much information about alternatives as we can.
Senator Winters.
Well, because so much of the discussion that was asked by, the question was asked by Representative Hanna, truly is what a political decision to come to out of this building. And as I know my community has said, and it said years ago, that they wanted the rest of the state to share the wealth and non-wealth, if you however you want to look at it, and so Salem has been very, very vocal.
I thought the expression was no more.
That's right. Salem has been extremely vocal on that issue. No more expansion of the institutions here at the state capitol, and so that also has been some of the dynamics that go to where do you go, and some of us who were here with the whole discussion of Coffee Creek, that was probably one of the most contentious siting issues, that we had to deal with. So you can't take the politics out of what's done in this building, unfortunately. And even though staff and administrators come and tell us that they may have a better plan that could be a lot more feasible and not cost us quite as much, quite frankly, but when you get the political play into it, it somehow changes all the good plans because of the politics. And so those are some of the elements that we're all dealing with.
Mr. Williams from the SACUF, did you have any closing comments?
No, we'll look forward to seeing the committee on Monday.
With that, there is...